complete silence. I felt as though I'd been hit by a boulder, lying across my bed, limp and crushed under the weight. "René Bordelon," the name echoed. "You got Rose killed." He had always been the link between Eve and me. Rose had worked for him. Eve had worked for him. Two women out of probably thousands who had labored in his employ over the decades. And because of that unremarkable fact, his name on a piece of paper had led me to Eve, and then here. But I had never thought the link more than a paper one. By dawn, I was dressed, packed, and headed out to the front steps of the auberge. It didn't surprise me to see Eve already there with her satchel at her feet, straight and fierce and smoking her first cigarette of the day. She turned, and I saw that her eyes were as red and grained as mine. "I'll do it," I said. "I'll help you track him down." "Good," Eve said, as matter-of-factly as if I'd agreed to help her get a cup of coffee. "Finn's getting the car." We stood and waited in the pink morning light. "Why do you even want my help?" I couldn't help asking. Another question I'd turned over last night. "You've wanted to bring this man to justice for more than 30 years. Wouldn't it be easier without some pregnant college girl in tow? You don't need me." Though a large part of me wished she did. I wanted to take care of her, even if she was prickly as a handful of needles. "No, I don't need you," she said briskly. "But the bastard's wronged both of us, not just me, and that means you have a right to revenge if you want it. I believe in revenge." Eve looked at me, inscrutable. "I've lost faith in much over the years, but not that." She stood there, tall and stony as an obelisk, and I wondered just what form her revenge was going to take. It gave me a disquieting pang as the Lagonda came around the corner. "Besides," Eve said in an undertone as Finn loaded the bags into the trunk, "I may not need you, but I definitely need him. And I put the odds at 50-50 that wherever you go, he goes." I blinked. "What makes you say that?" She touched a red mark on my throat that I'd seen in the mirror this morning and tried to cover with my loosened hair. A mark Finn's mouth had left last night. "I know the difference between a mosquito bite and a love bite, Yank." "Done with your blithering, ladies." Finn came around the driver's side. "That's a braw morning for a drive." "Yes," I mumbled, ears burning. Eve grinned as she climbed into the back seat. Finn missed the grin, but he saw my red flush and paused after he stood behind the wheel. "All right, lass," he asked quietly. There wasn't really a word for what I was after the past day and night together. Grieving and hopeful, profoundly shocked and profoundly angry. Angrier every time I looked at the photograph of the old man we had all agreed to track down. And if I looked at Finn, my skin tingled with an all-over flash of what had passed between us, not 12 hours ago. "I'm all right," I said finally. He nodded, and I couldn't tell how things stood between us, if he was sorry or not for what had happened. So I left him to put the car in gear and turned to Eve in the back seat. "One thing you haven't told us. How do we find René Bordelon? He's not going by that name anymore. Or René de Malassis either. And we don't know where he went when he fled Limoges. So how do we pick up his trail from here?" Eve took a last drag of her cigarette and flicked the end into the street. "I have an idea about that. He told me more than once that he intended to retire in Grasse, that he even had some dilapidated property there, an old villa he might restore some day. He's 73 now. He won't be starting another restaurant. Sounds like retired to me. I'll wager he went to rebuild that villa, read his books, play his music, and enjoy the southern sunshine. I say we go to Grasse. And do what?" I raised my eyebrows. "Drive around looking out the window? Give me some credit, Yank. René never told me where his property in Grasse was, but I've got some good ideas of how to find it. But what if he isn't there at all?" Finn sounded doubtful. "All we have is a few chance remarks made more than 30 years ago. Has anyone here got a better idea of where to start?" Admittedly, I didn't. I shrugged. Finn reached for the set of maps crumpled at my feet.
"At an easy pace, we make Grasse in 2 days. Stop in Grenoble tonight."
"Grenoble it is," Eve tilted her head back, closing her eyes to the sky.
Step on it, Scotsman.
The Lagonda hummed along southeast, the three of us each lost in our own thoughts. I found myself looking at the photograph of René again. I wondered what that SS officer had looked like, the one who gave the orders to massacre the village. I wondered what the German soldiers had looked like, the ones who could look at a girl fleeing a burning church with a baby in her arms and be willing to pull the trigger. Anger flushed through me, slow and burning, and I thought of what Eve had said about those men, that I'd likely never find out which soldiers killed Rose. Maybe I could, someday. Names had to exist, records. Maybe the German soldiers who survived could be brought to trial, not just for Rose, but for Madame Ruffonche and her murdered village. Oradour-sur-Glane deserved justice for its dead as much as any of the atrocities investigated at Nuremberg. But that was a problem for another day. Here, now, aimed for Grasse, the Nazis who had a hand in Rose's death were out of my reach. But René Bordelon might not be. As the car rolled through ever-rising hills and the gorgeous expanse of lakes and pastures, I pondered a new equation. Rose plus Lily, divided by Eve plus me, equaling René Bordelon. Four women with one man among us all. I stared at his face in the grainy photograph, looking for remorse, guilt, cruelty. But you couldn't see those things in a picture. He was just an old man out to dinner. I tried to tuck the photograph back into Eve's satchel, but her gnarled hand lashed out like a whip and knocked mine away.
Keep it.
The photograph went into my pocketbook, and I could feel that man's empty eyes staring at me through the leather. So I turned around and looked back at Eve. She looked steadier, lighter than the hunched, guilt-consumed figure in the windowsill last night, reciting her tale of torture and self-loathing. I reached out and touched her hand gently. "You wouldn't tell us about your trial last night," I said. "Or what happened to you and Lily and Violette afterward."
"Not a tale for dark nights."
I tilted my head up at the hot sun above. "No shadows now." She let out a long breath.
"I suppose not."
Finn and I listened as she told us of the trial, the Belgian lions, the hammering questions in German, the reduced sentences, Violette spitting in her face. I remembered the older Violette in Roubaix doing the same, and shivered at the echo. Violette. An idea pricked me there, an insistent little thought I'd had last night as well. An equation that didn't balance out. But I pushed that aside for now, as Eve said.
"Then we came to Siegburg."
Chapter 34. Eve. March 1916. After the war ended, Eve was surprised by how little impression Siegburg's endless flow of days had made in her memory. Her time as a spy in Lille had stretched not even 6 months, yet she remembered it all in diamond-edged clarity. 2.5 years in Siegburg passed like a foul grey dream, every day the same as the one before.
"Sicher tu hast sel."
That was her welcome to Siegburg, in the spring of 16. A brusque order, and then a heavy hand in the middle of her back, shoving her down a dark corridor after Lily and Violette. None of them had had a look at the prison's outside. It was far too dark by the time the rattling van pulled into the courtyard.
"Never mind," Lily whispered. "We shall have a good look at it over our shoulders, the day we're released."
But it was hard to think of release when being shoved along a corridor that smelled of piss and sweat and despair. Eve found herself shivering, pressing her teeth together so they would not rattle. The creak of a key being turned, hinges squealing, and then a massive door yawned.
"Gardener!"
the guard barked, and that same brusque hand shoved Eve forward.
"Wait!"
She turned, frantic for a glimpse of Lily and Violette, but the door had already slammed. The blackness was absolute, a pool of stifling, freezing darkness. "Everyone breaks down the first night." Eve would hear that later from her fellow prisoners. But Eve came to Siegburg, already broken. The blackness was not nearly as terrible as the inside of her own mind. So she merely unlocked her chattering teeth and felt her way around the cell with misshapen fingers. Stone walls, smaller in dimension than her cell in Saint-Gilles. A foul bed, hard as wood and stinking of old sweat, old vomit, old terror.
They've wondered how many women had slept and cried and stifled their screams in that bed. Dimly through the door she heard cries, once a burst of shrill laughter, but no guard answered the calls. Once the cells were locked for the night at Siegburg, Eve learned soon enough. They weren't open until morning. A woman might be dying slowly of fever or blood poisoning, shrieking with pain over a broken bone, writhing in the agony of giving birth. The door still wouldn't open until dawn. A good many died that way. That was, Eve supposed dully, the entire point. She couldn't lie down on that foul bed. She curled in the corner on the stones, shaking with cold, waiting for morning. Dawn arrived in the company of a hard-faced guard, marching in with a stack of clothes. Rough blue stockings, dirty white frock with a great prisoner's cross on the chest. And the endless string of captive days began. Hunger, cold, lice, slaps from the guards. The daily labor, rough sewing with pricked fingers, polishing latches with a brace of cleaners, pushing together little caps of metal. Whispered conversations with the other women. Was it true that there had been a battle at Montsorel, the Somme? Was it true the British had captured La Boiselle, Contralmaison? Even more than food, the prisoners craved news. All they heard from the guards was that the Germans were winning. Liars, Lily snorted. Such liars. They're losing and they know it. All we need to do is endure. Endure, Eve thought. A year slipped by. More foul grey days, more slaps, more lice, more screams in the night. Lily's serene confidence, burning brighter even as her body whittled down to stark bone. Black, dreamless nights on that foul-smelling cot. Seeing women sweat to death from yellowing fevers, waste away under the twin grinding stones of cold and hunger. Seeing them stagger to the infirmary, that huge room with its ugly green shades that stank of shit and blood. Some called it the Lazaretto. Some just called it hell. You didn't go to the infirmary to be treated. You went there to die. The Germans didn't need to waste bullets killing their female prisoners when neglect and disease could do it for them. A sound strategy, Eve thought remotely. Women dying in hospital beds resulted in far less international outcry than women dying before firing squads. And what women these were. Identical skeletons wearing the same prisoner's cross, dirty-haired, hollow-eyed Fleur du Mal, every one. Fiery Louise Delise, who had smuggled soldiers across borders for Edith Cavell. Belgian-born Madame Ramey, whose son had been shot and whose two daughters had accompanied her to prison. The stoic Princesse de Cruy, who had organized a spy network in Belgium. Before Siegburg, Eve had never known just how many women there were who had risked all for the war. Even now, in their way, they continued to fight. Madame Blanquette says those little steel caps we have been given to assemble are grenade heads, Lily whispered. Shall we do something about it? Lily, Violette said wearily. Don't provoke them. Ta gueule. It's inconceivable that we be put to work on ammunition to be used against our countrymen. And the following day the words were shouted out. In the name of England, of France, of Belgium, and of all allied countries, I implore my companions to adamantly refuse to work on munitions. Germany does not have the right to demand from us this work of death against our homelands, to force us to ourselves make the engines which, in battle, will strike our fathers, our brothers, our husbands, our sons. We all here continue to fight and suffer courageously for King, for our flags, for our homelands. And all over Siegburg, the grey-faced female skeletons were suddenly alight, screaming like Valkyries, even as the guards ran back and forth, shoving, slapping, shouting. Eve screamed until her throat stung, even when she got a clenched fist across the cheekbone that snapped her head back like a whip. The world for a moment was bright, screaming color rather than soul-leeching grey. Eve screamed until she was bundled back into her cell, and Lily laughed even as the guards hauled her and Madame Blanquette away to solitary confinement for inciting the strike. Well worth it, she said when they finally let her out a month later. Eve wasn't sure. Lily was just a handful of bones, insubstantial as a shadow. Eve dropped her own blanket around the other woman's shoulders. Endure. All we need do is endure.
Another endless grey year. A freezing spring coming late in 1918, and with it a cautious hope feathering its way through the prisoners. "The Bosch are losing," the whisper went around as the year advanced. "They're beaten, falling back everywhere along the front." It wasn't just the whispered rumors that made their way inside prison walls. Rumors of English victories and French encroachments on German territory. Everyone could see the slump in the shoulders of the guards, hear the increasing shrillness in the assertions of German victory. It hovered in the air. The bloody slog of war might finally be coming to an end. If it had ended sooner, Eve later thought on the long nights when she was staring down the barrel of a Luger. If it had ended just a few short months sooner. September, 1918. "Thank you for coming, little Daisy." Lily lay in the cold infirmary, her body hardly making an impression below the grubby blankets. Eve perched on the cot's edge, shivering in her prison smock. She should have been with the other women working, but there had been a typhus epidemic not long ago, and when Eve reported feeling feverish and headachy, they were quick to send her to the infirmary. Easy then to sneak from her own cot to Lily's. "How are you feeling?" she managed to ask. "Not so terrible." Lily patted her side. For a while now she'd suffered from a pleural abscess between two of her ribs, but had made light of it. "The surgeon will lance the thing, and it will be done." The surgery was scheduled for 4 PM. "Not long now." "They're bringing a surgeon from Bonn." Eve tried to quell her apprehension. Lancing an abscess was surely minor surgery. But in this understaffed hellhole, on a half-starved woman... "Lily is not afraid," Eve reminded herself. "Don't you be either." But perhaps Lily was afraid, because she fixed Eve with an unusually sober gaze. Her lively eyes were sunk into a face that was little more than a skull. "Take care of Violette for me, if..." An expressive shrug. "You're going to be fine." Eve cut her off before she could go further. "You have to be." It was what she'd clung to for more than 2 years. Evelyn Gardner had betrayed her friends, had broken down and brought them to this foul place. If she could bring them out again safely, some part of that betrayal could be forgotten, if not ever forgiven. It was what she thought every day when she pushed half her bread ration to Lily's hands, when she tried to give her blankets to Violette, even though Violette still looked at her with stony eyes. "Bring them out safely, and you will have atoned." And she'd almost done it. Surely the war could not go on much longer. "We are almost there. Almost home." Perhaps Lily saw some of that desperation in Eve's eyes, because she reached out and laid her emaciated fingers over Eve's misshapen ones. "Take care of yourself, little Daisy. If I'm not here to haul you out of trouble, don't say that." Eve gripped Lily's hand, panic choking her. She was not going to lose Lily, not over an abscess. Not now. Not after more than 2 years of imprisonment. Not so close to the end. "It's just a lance and drain operation. Of course you'll survive." Lily's voice was steady. "But the Germans have no interest in my survival, ma petite." Eve's eyes welled, because she couldn't deny it. The officials of Zygborg hated every bone in Lily's troublemaking body, and made no secret of it. "You shouldn't have let that strike, or..." "Or what? Caused strife from the day she walked through Zeichberg's doors? Planned elaborate escapes? Kept spirits high with jokes and stories?" If Lily had been the sort to keep her head low, she would not have led the most efficient spy network in France. "You are going to be fine," Eve repeated stubbornly, and would have said more, but two orderlies appeared.
"Up, Bertignier. The surgeon has arrived."
Lily could barely stand. Eve slid an arm around her shoulder, lifting her to her feet. She wore a shapeless, dish-rag-colored smock, and she made a face at it.
"Quelle horreur! What I'd give for something in pink moiré. And a morally questionable hat," Eve managed to say. "I'd settle for some morally questionable soap. My hair is filthy."
Eve's throat caught. "Lily, pray for me when I go in there." gesturing with her sharp little chin in the direction of the surgery. I need people praying for me. I wrote a letter to my old mother prioress in Anderlecht. But I'll take your prayers any day, Evelyn Gardner. It was the first time Lily used Eve's real name. Even after the trial, they went on using the old code names, the ones that felt true. I cannot pray for you, Eve whispered. I do not believe in God anymore. But I do. Lily kissed the rosary knotted through her fingers, even as the orderlies took her by the elbows. So Eve jerked out a nod. Then I'll pray, she said. And I'll see you in a few hours. I will. They hauled Lily out of the infirmary, Eve following behind. A nurse came out of the surgery at the end of the corridor, and for a moment Eve had a glimpse of the surgeon from Bonn smoking a cigarette. There was no bustle, Eve saw. No one sterilizing instruments. No one was making preparations with ether or chloroform. Lily, she thought in a wash of dread. Lily, don't go in there. Ahead she heard Lily's clear voice reciting her rosary. Pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our deaths. The corridor outside was thronged with women. Louise Thelise, the Princesse de Croy, Violette, as many of the Fleur du Mal who could steal away from their work shifts, all anxious glances and murmured prayers for the Queen of Spies. The two orderlies picked up their feet, hastening Lily along, and her voice faltered in its calm recitation. For a moment Eve thought Lily would finally break, that she would collapse and weep, have to be carried off prostrate to her operating table. No. She straightened between the orderlies, lifting her chin in the old impish gesture, eyes darting along the line of her friends. The dull light struck her hair, coiled around her head in matted blonde braids, and it had the look of a crown. Mes amis, she said softly, and as she passed Violette, she reached out and pressed her rosary into those trembling hands. Je vous aime. And she was gone past them, tiny as a child between the two orderlies, almost floating as she went light-footed, light-hearted, down the long corridor toward the operating room. Eve felt her own heart beating sickly, somber as a drum. Lily. Just before she disappeared, Lily turned her head back one final time and gave her swift, mischievous glance. She blew a kiss to the Fleur du Mal, and it hit Eve like a physical blow. Then Lily disappeared into the operating room, but her voice still floated out, merry and serene. You must be the surgeon. I wonder if I can have some chloroform, because it's been an absolute pisser of a day. That was when Eve's knees buckled. That was when she knew. She'll be fine, Louise Thelise was saying. It would take more than a lung abscess to bring down our Lily. Nothing at all. More murmurs of agreement. Assurances spoken over eyes full of worry. Violette clutched the rosary so hard its looped beads cut into her fingers. She'll be out of bed within a week. Less than a week. But Violette wasn't there in the infirmary for the next 4 hours, as Eve was. The guards shooed the prisoners away, but Eve was still under observation for typhus symptoms. She was just a corridor and a locked door away when the moans came, and the whimpers, and the strangled screams. The sounds of a woman being operated upon without ether, without chloroform, without morphine. Eve sat huddled on her cot, as all her stubborn hope drained away, sobbing so hard she almost drowned out the noise of Lily's agony. But not quite. Eve heard it all, start to finish. By morning she had sobbed herself mute. Her voice was gone. And so was Lily. Excerpt from La Guerre des Femmes, Memoir of Louise de Bettigny's War Work, by Antoine Redier, as told to him by his wife, Leonie Van Houten, codename Violette Lameron. She finished as she had lived. A soldier. Chapter 35. Charlie. June 1947. My head hurt. I'd so hoped that the Queen of Spies was still alive, that we might meet her on this journey as we'd met Violette. A white-haired woman now, but still small and gallant and merry. Someone I'd ached to know. But she'd never had the chance to grow old. Eve, I wanted to say to the figure hunched in the back seat. I'm so sorry. But words were just air, useless after a tale like that. Finn had pulled the Lagonda over to the side of the road 20 minutes before as we listened. And now we sat in the summer sun, utterly still. I reached out for Eve's knobbed hands as she lowered them from her face. But she was speaking again, looking pale and ravaged in the merciless sunlight. There it is. You know it all. Lily died the ugliest death a brave woman ever suffered. And it was all thanks to me. I sent her inside those walls, and I failed to bring her out again. Denial boiled in me furiously. No. No, you were not to blame. You cannot think that. But she did think that, and all the words in the world from me would not shift her self-loathing. I knew that much about Evelyn Gardner. As much as I was always yearning to fix what was broken, I could do nothing to fix Eve. Or could I? She passed a gnarled hand across her mouth. Both were trembling. "Get this car moving, Scotsman," she said hoarsely. "We aren't getting to Grenoble by sitting on a roadside." Finn steered the Lagonda back onto the road, and we finished the long drive in silence, worn out from the stark, ugly end of Eve's confession. Eve sat him back with her eyes closed. Finn drove like a chauffeur, looking front and center, only speaking up to ask for a map. As for me, I sat turning over an idea. A lovely city, Grenoble. Compact houses and pretty little churches. The lazy blue meandering of the rivers Drac and Isère, framed all around by the distant cloud-wrapped Alps. Another auberge, and Finn helped Eve up the stairs with the baggage, casting a glance back at me. "I have to make a telephone call," I said, and he probably thought I meant to my family. But the call I put through at the hotel desk, after a long wrangle with the French operator, wasn't to the United States. It was to a china shop in Roubaix, whose name I fortunately remembered. "Allô?" I'd only met her once, but I knew her voice immediately. I imagined her turning her head, spectacles reflecting the light. "Violette Lameron," I greeted her. A long pause. "Who are you?" "Charlotte Sinclair, madame. You saw me not long ago. I came into the shop with Eve Gardner. Marguerite Lefrancois, as you knew her. Please don't hang up." Because she was on the verge, I could tell from the controlled rasp of breathing on the other end of the line. "What do you want?" Her voice came noticeably colder. "I wouldn't help that Judas bitch out of a burning house. So if it's a favor for her..." I fought down a swell of anger, the urge to snap that nothing was Eve's fault. The urge to ask how well she would have held out against a glass of opium and 10 broken fingers. But Violette was as invested in Eve's guilt as Eve was herself, and nothing I could say would shift either of them. Only facts would do that. And for the facts, I needed Violette. "Someone needs to look into the trial records where you and Eve and Lily were sentenced." I lowered my voice, turning my back on the curious hotel clerk. "I believe there's a lie hiding in there." I'd thought it from the first, hearing about the exchange of information that condemned Lily. Something there did not add up correctly. Solve for X. Violette sounded rather contemptuous. "You're just a little American. What could you possibly know about records for a European trial 30 years past?" I could surmise a lot more than she thought. Although summers working in my father's office, specializing in international law, I'd indexed and notated French and German legal books. I'd filed trial paperwork. I'd heard my father expound over dinner as he compared European and American law. The trial of 3 female spies in the heart of wartime would have been very well documented, I told Violette. "You 3 were heroines, famous. German officers, French newspapers, Belgian clerks, English diplomats, all paying attention that day. Everything about your trial would have been filed away, if only so it could be produced as proof of no wrongdoing later. If there's a lie in there, it can be found. It's just a matter of getting a look at the records. Will you help?" "What's lie?" Violette asked, curiosity sharpening her voice despite herself. "Got you," I thought, and told her. An even longer silence fell. Why ask me? You don't know me, mademoiselle. I know what you're capable of, because Yves told me all about you. You won't stop until you get the truth. I don't know if the trial records are public or sealed after all this time. But if they're sealed, I imagine you could get access much more easily than me. Because you were on trial that day, and you can argue your right to know the full story. And you don't have the full story, you or Yves, because you didn't hear all the deliberations. I laid out a little honey, thinking it couldn't hurt. You're a war heroine, Violette. Surely there are powerful people who still respect you, who owe you favors, who will pull strings for you. You'll find a way to get the information if it's there. And if it is? Just tell me. Tell me if I'm right. Please. She was silent so long I feared the connection had dropped. I stood there dry-mouthed at the desk. Please, I begged silently. Violette sounded bemused when she spoke, but she sounded honed as well, as if the spy inside the respectable shopkeeper had opened her eyes for the first time in years. I didn't think that part ever died, not in women like Yves and Violette. Where would I contact you, Mademoiselle St. Clair, if I found anything? I promised to telephone her from Grasse tomorrow with the name of our hotel, and hung up feeling shaky. I cast a fishing line to the water. Now all I could do was wait and see if anything came up on the other end. I wondered, going upstairs, if I should tell Yves what I'd done, but answered myself with a resounding no. She looked so fragile in the car, frail enough to crumble at the slightest blow. I wasn't raising her hope about anything until I had something in hand to warrant it. Entering the silence of my pretty little room, I flung open the shutters and looked out into the fast-falling twilight. Couples promenaded below, arm in arm, and I remembered Rose and me laughing about someday being old enough to go on double dates. I saw a tall blonde hand in hand with a laughing boy, but my memory didn't subtly try to give her Rose's face. She was just a girl, no one I knew. My hallucinatory flashes of seeing Rose everywhere I looked seemed to have stopped since Oradour sur Glane. Come back, I thought, looking at the throng. Come back, Rosie. But of course she wasn't coming back. Like my brother, she was dead. A knock sounded. I thought it might be Yves, come to tell me what she had planned once we arrived in Grasse. But it was Finn. He looked different, and it took me a moment to put my finger on it. He'd shaved, put on a jacket, worn at the elbows, but a handsome dark blue, and his shoes had been shined to a gleam.
Come to dinner with me,
he said without preamble. I didn't think Yves would come down to eat tonight. She looked like she wanted a whiskey supper. Whatever got her to oblivion fastest. Knowing now how Lily had died and how it haunted her, I could understand that better.
Gardner's done for the night.
Finn patted his pocket, jingling with Eve's nightly haul of bullets.
It'll just be us. Come to dinner with me, Charlie.
Something in his tone made me straighten. From the way he'd dressed up, I didn't think he meant one of our usual quick refueling stops at the nearest cafe. Is this a date? I asked, keeping my hand from going to my must hair.
Yes.
His eyes were steady.
That's what a man does when he likes a lass. Puts on a jacket, puts a shine on his shoes, asks her to dinner.
I don't know any men who do that. Not after we already... I got a flash of what we'd done in the car last night, the windows fogged up and our breath coming ragged.
Your trouble is, your experience is all with boys, not men.
I raised my eyebrows. Is that the gray-bearded voice of wisdom, coming from a man not quite 30?
What I mean is, it's not a matter of age. There are boys aged 50, and men aged 15. It's all in what they do, not how old they are.
He paused.
A boy messes up with a lass, and he slinks off without fixing anything. A man makes a mistake, he fixes it. He apologizes.
You're sorry for what happened then? I remembered him last night, his hands spanning my naked back, as he said not too distinctly, this wasn't how I wanted to do this. My heart squeezed. I wasn't sorry at all.
I don't regret it one bit.
His voice was even,
I'm just sorry it wasn't slower. Done after dinner and a date, not a fist fight and a bruised lip. That's not how you start things with a lass you like, and I like you, Charlie. You're smarter than any woman I know. A wee little adding machine in a black dress, and I like that. You've got a sharp tongue, and I like that too. You try to save everyone you meet, from your cousin and your brother, to hopeless cock-ups like Gardner and me, and I like that most of all. So I'm here to apologize. I'm here to take you to dinner. I'm here in a jacket. Pause. I hate jackets. I fought the smile spreading over my face, but I failed. He gave a smile back that was all in the crinkles around his eyes, and it made me positively weak in the knees. I cleared my throat, tugging at my striped jersey, and said, "Give me 10 minutes of change." "Done." He pulled the door closed. An instant later, his voice floated through. "Can you wear that black dress again?" "I didn't say it would be much of a dinner," he said. We leaned on the stone balustrade of an old bridge over the River Isère, a packet of sandwiches between us. Finn had bought them from a café near the Place Saint-André, and we were eating them right out of paper wrappings. "I'm a bit skint." "We wouldn't get a better view in a fancy restaurant. A dark night full of stars, the flow of water scattered with broken moonlight, and the murmur and rush of the city around us."
"Your favorite food," Finn said suddenly. "What is it?"
I laughed. "Why?"
"That's something I don't know about you. There's a lot I don't know about you, Miss Sinclair."
He reached out and touched a crumb on my lip, dabbing it away.
"That's what a first date is for. So, favorite food?"
"He used to be a hamburger. Onion, lettuce, dab of mustard. No cheese. But since the rosebud here..." Patting my stomach. "It's bacon. Crispy, burned just a little. The way I'm eating, there won't be a pig left in France by the time this baby's born. What's your favorite food, Mr. Kilgore?"
"Fish and chips from a proper chippy. Lots of malt vinegar." "Favorite color?"
I eyed his jacket, which made his hair look darker and his shoulders broader. "Blue."
"Same here. Last book you read?"
We traded back and forth, both of us a little silly and enjoying it. Finn asked me about college, and I told him about Bennington and algebra classes. I asked him how he'd gotten so good with cars, and he told me about working in his uncle's garage at age 11. The little things, the getting to know you things. Normally those conversations happened early on, before anyone got half naked in the back seat of a convertible. But we'd done it all backward.
"The first thing you'd buy if you had £10,000 sterling.
"My grandmother's pearls back. I love those pearls. You?"
"A 46 Bentley Mark VI, Finn said promptly. "First car made by Bentley and Rolls. That's a beauty. Though if it's £10,000 I've got, maybe I could go all the way to the Ferrari 125S. It just debuted. Took 6 of 13 races on the Piacenza circuit."
He started telling me about the V12 engine, and it was utterly adorable. I couldn't have told you why it was adorable. When Trevor Preston Green bought me a milkshake after English Lit and droned on for an hour about his Chevrolet Stylemaster coup, I wanted to upend my chocolate malt over his hair. But now I stood utterly charmed as Finn told me all about the Dodean type rear suspension.
"Listen to me blethering on,"
he broke off finally, seeing me smile. "Yes," I said, bored to tears here. "Tell me more about the 5-speed gearbox."
"Makes a car go zoom," he said straight-faced. "Your turn to blether about something boring."
"The Pythagorean equation," I said, picking something easy. "A squared plus B squared equals C squared. That means that for all right-angled triangles, the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides." Finn mimed clutching his hair. "Really now, simple Euclidean geometry is no reason for despair." We both laughed, tossing our sandwich crusts down for the geese honking noisily below. Afterward, we just leaned against the stones, gazing out at the water in comfortable silence. I wasn't used to silence on dates. Girls weren't supposed to let silence fall. You had to keep the conversation going so he wouldn't think you were a sad sack.
Be interesting, be sparkling, or he won't ask you out again. But the silence now was as comfortable as the chatter. He was the one to break it, voice thoughtful.
You think Gardner's right about Bordelon being in Gas somewhere, retired and waiting to be found? Or is she half-cracked?
I hesitated, not wanting to disrupt this gentle peace with reality. It seems like an awful long shot, but she's been right more often than she's been wrong. A question of my own burst out. What happens if we do find him? What is Eve going to do?
If she can prove he's René de Malassis from Limoges, who collaborated with the Nazis and formed for the Milice, and shot an employee in the back merely for petty theft, she can turn him in.
Finn dusted the last sandwich crumbs off his hands.
De Gaulle isn't kind to profiteering killers, even elderly ones. Bordelon would face prison, especially if it can be proved his collaboration resulted in the... in what happened at Oradour-sur-Glan. He'd lose his reputation, his freedom.
Is that going to be enough for Eve? Finn looked at me. I looked at him.
No,
we said at the same time, and his hand covered mine on the stone parapet of the bridge. We need to stop her from doing anything irrevocable, Finn. Real life wasn't a movie. In the real world, there were consequences for revenge. Consequences like prison. And Eve might have endured Psychborg as a girl. But I didn't think she'd survive now if she went to prison for assault, or whatever they called it in France. I'm not letting her burn up the rest of her life just to take that old bastard out.
But it's her life, isn't it?
Finn's fingers slid inside mine, so our hands slowly interlaced.
I've been with Gardner a while now. I can understand her wanting to risk it all to make something right.
Killing an old man is making things right. I can't be a party to that, even if he is a back-shooting murderer. I shivered, partly from the terrible thought, and partly because Finn's thumb was passing back and forth along the back of my hand, leaving tingles. We'll have to make sure she doesn't go off the rails.
Wasn't that going to be a job? A job for tomorrow.
Finn tugged me away from the balustrade.
Promise me something, Charlie.
What?
Don't look at that photograph tomorrow. Just enjoy the drive.
We meandered back to the hotel hand in hand, largely silent. Finn opened the door to guide me through, fingertips resting on my bare back, above the black dress's low V-slash. And my skin rippled. He walked me down the corridor to my room, formally, as if I had a father who cared about my curfew glaring at the clock.
I had a lovely time, he said,
very solemn.
I'll ring you tomorrow.
Boys never call.
Men call.
We lingered inside our fragile bubble of happiness, the kind of happiness that sits on top of melancholy as easily as icing on a cake. I didn't want to leave it. I'm no good at this, Finn, I said at last. A Yank in a black dress plus a Scotsman in a jacket, multiplied by a summer night and a packet of sandwiches, divided by an awkward silence and the fact that the Yank had a pregnant belly. I didn't know how that equation came out, what it equaled. What happens now? He sounded hoarse.
What happens now is entirely up to you.
Oh. I stood a moment looking at him, and then I went up on tiptoe. Our lips met, soft as drifting feathers, and I melted into him as his arms circled my waist. We kissed, slow and endless, Finn pressing me soft and yielding between the hard door and his hard chest. And I fumbled blindly behind me for the handle. The door burst open and we spilled through it, kissing and stumbling, my shoes landing on top of his discarded jacket. Finn got a hand loose from my hair and batted the door shut. He picked me up then, holding me in the air for another kiss. And then he made me shriek as he dropped me on the bed, from what seemed like a very long height. He stood for a moment looking down at me, and I couldn't believe I was this nervous. We'd already done this, but not in a bed, not with lights on. He dropped down with a groan, stretching himself long and luxuriant over me.
Beds,
he said, dropping slow kisses along my neck, the Scots burr coming thicker.
Not a very big improvement on box seats.
I fit just fine in both,
I said as I tugged at his shirt.
Because you're a midget.
He submitted to my tugging, let me pull his shirt over his head, then flipped me back down, grinning.
Quit rushing. It's not supposed to be a sprint.
Thought you liked fast, I managed to say. In the light, he was lean and brown and beautiful. You and your 5-speed gearboxes.
Car should be fast. Bed should be slow.
I tangled my hands in his hair, feeling my back arch as he dragged the zipper of my dress down inch by inch. How slow?
Very slow,
he murmured against my lips.
Takes all night where we're going.
All night? I hooked my legs around him, looking at the dark eyes so close to mine our lashes brushed. I am falling for you, I thought bemusedly. I am falling so hard. You've got to drive all the way to Grasse tomorrow, I whispered instead. What about sleep?
Sleep?
His hands twined through my hair so tight it hurt as he growled into my ear.
Quit your blethering.
Chapter 36 Eve March, 1919 It was Eve's first step back in England since her career as a spy began. Folkestone, where Cameron had stood waving goodbye as Eve sailed to Le Havre. Where he stood now, coat rippling about his knees, waiting for her on the pier.
Miss Gardner,
he said when she stepped off the ferry. It had been some months since her release. She'd lived that time in a bathtub, scrubbing obsessively as arrangements were made to bring her back from her temporary lodgings in Louvain to England. Captain Cameron, she answered.
No, it's Major Cameron now, isn't it?
Eyeing his new insignia. In addition to his majority was the blue and red ribbon of the DSO on the left breast of his uniform coat.
I've missed a few things, being away. I was hoping to bring you back to England sooner.
Eve shrugged. The women of Siegburg had been released before the armistice was even signed, let loose from their cells by defeated-looking prison officials, stampeding in a weeping, joyous flood for the trains that would take them home. Eve would have been weeping with joy, too, had Lily been arm-in-arm with her to take that train. After Lily died, it had not mattered in the slightest how fast she could get away from Siegburg. Cameron's eyes were going over her now, registering the changes. Eve knew she was still thin as a rack, her hair straw dry from lice treatments and packed close to her skull. She kept her hands thrust into her pockets so he couldn't see the misshapen knuckles. But there was nothing she could do to hide her eyes, which never sat still anymore. Eve took in the world in constant darting glances now, looking for danger on all sides. Even here on the open pier, she angled her back against the nearest piling, seeking protection. Eve registered the shock in Cameron's own steady eyes as he saw how deeply the past few years had marked her. They hadn't been kind to him either. Deep lines graven about his mouth, broken veins at his forehead, streaks of grey at his temples. I used to love you, Eve thought. But it was a blank thought, almost meaningless. She used to feel a lot of things before Lily died. Now what she mainly felt was grief and rage and guilt, devouring each other like tail-eating serpents, and the never-ending whisper of her blood saying, betrayer. I thought there would be some three-ring circus, Eve said at last, nodding at the empty pier. She had been almost the only person to disembark. Folkestone, now that the war was over, had reverted to a much sleepier place, and there were no aides or military attachés anywhere in sight. Major Allenton was in touch, kept going on about a welcome ceremony. Apparently Evelyn Gardner was now a heroine. So were many of the other female prisoners. Violette, Eve heard, was feted all over Roubaix when she returned home. Eve would be feted too if she'd allow it, which she wouldn't.
I talked Allenton out of the public welcome, Cameron said. He wanted a few generals to greet you, some newspaper men and so on. A brass band.
Fortunate you discouraged him, though I'd have enjoyed hammering a bloody tuba over his ears. Eve hitched her satchel over her shoulder and set off down the pier.
I thought I'd see you in France.
Cameron fell in beside her.
at Louise de Bettigny's funeral. I meant to go.
Eve had got as far as Cologne, where Lily's original grave was to be opened, so her body could be repatriated back to her homeland. But never made it out of the hotel room. She'd ended up getting drunk instead, and nearly shooting the maid who came with her supper. The girl was squat, square-faced. And for a horrific moment, Eve had thought she was the frog, that horrible woman in Lille who had strip-searched Eve and Lily. The memory dizzied Eve now, momentarily, and she gulped a deep breath of sea air. Cameron's voice was low.
Why didn't you come?
Couldn't face it. She'd said her goodbye to Lily in a corridor that stank of typhus and blood. She didn't need a graveside with droning plaudits and French generals. But she didn't say that to Cameron, just quickened her steps, suddenly needing to be away from him. Cameron's long legs kept up.
Do you have anyone to meet you? A place to stay?
I'll find something. His hand caught her elbow.
Eve, stop. Let me help you, for God's sake.
She wrenched free. He didn't mean any harm, but she couldn't bear to be touched. There were a lot of things she was finding she couldn't bear, now that she was out of prison. Open windows, crowds, wide spaces without corners to set her back against. Sleep. Keep it Miss Gardner, Cameron. Far better that way. She looked out at the ocean rather than meet his gaze. His soft eyes might swallow her whole, and Eve couldn't be soft. Not now.
Tell me, she said instead.
We didn't get much news about the war inside prison, and now no one wants to go over old battles. Lily's last message, the one about the Verdun assault. Over and over, Eve had wondered how that assault went, what they changed by getting that message through. How did things go down?
The French commander received your information.
Cameron looked as if he wanted to stop there, but Eve's gaze pierced him, and he continued reluctantly.
The report about the coming assault was given, but it wasn't believed. Losses were, well, very bad.
Eve squeezed her eyes shut, feeling something rise in her throat. It was either a laugh or a scream. So it was all worth nothing. Lily giving up her freedom so that report could get through. Eve leaving Cameron's sleeping arms and walking back into mortal danger because such reports were worth risking her life for. All of it rendered useless. Nothing Eve or Lily or Violette had done had avoided the bloodbath. Nothing I did in France ever amounted to anything. His voice was fierce.
No, do not think that.
He would have seized her shoulders, but he sensed her recoil.
The Alice Network saved hundreds, Eve, perhaps thousands. You were the best network in the war. None of the others in France or Belgium ever equaled it.
Eve smiled, mirthless. Who cared about praise when the failures were so much bigger than the victories? That miracle chance in 15 to kill the Kaiser failed. Stopping the assault on Verdun failed. Keeping the network together after Lily's arrest failed. Cameron had gone on.
I don't know if you've read Major Allenton's communications. He says you never responded. But you've been awarded these. He meant to award them to you at Louise's funeral. She received the same, posthumously.
Eve refused to take the case, so after an awkward pause, Cameron opened it for her. Four medals glittered in Eve's blurring vision.
The Medal de Guerre, the Croix de Guerre with palm, the Croix de la Légion d'honneur, and the Order of the British Empire, awarded in honor of your war efforts.
Tin toys. Eve took a hand from her pocket at last and knocked them to the ground, trembling.
I don't want any medals. Then Major Allenton will hold them for you. Cram them up his arse.
Cameron gathered Eve's medals and dropped them back into the case.
I didn't want mine either, believe me.
But you had to take them, because you're still in the army. Eve gave a one-note bark of a laugh. The army doesn't want me anymore. I did my part and the war's over, so now they'll pin some bits of tin on me and tell me to bugger off back to the file room. Well, they can keep their damned tin scraps.
Cameron flinched this time at her language. His eyes dropped, and Eve realized she hadn't put her hand back in her pocket. His eyes went from her fingers to her face and back, as though he were seeing the demure, quiet-voiced girl he'd sent away to France with her carpet bag in her soft hands and her innocence. War and torture and prison and René Bordelon had happened, and now she was nothing like that girl. She was a damaged wreck of a woman with a foul mouth and destroyed hands and no innocence at all. "Not your fault," Eve wanted to say to the guilty sorrow in his eyes. But he wouldn't believe her. She sighed, flexing her ruined fingers.
"You had to to know about these," she said. "There was a report." "Knowing's not the same as seeing."
He reached out for the crippled hand but stopped himself. She was glad. She didn't want to keep shoving him away. He hadn't earned that. He gave a sigh of his own instead.
"Let's get a drink."
It was a horrible pub on the docks, the kind of place where gravel-voiced women slopped gin into grimy glasses for men who were already drunk at 10 in the morning. But it was just what Eve needed. Anonymous, cheap, windowless, so she didn't worry about people sneaking up behind her. 2 shots of gin, followed by a pint of bitter, steadied her jumping pulse. She used to be proud of that slow pulse that got her through danger, but it had been a long time since she'd held up that coolly under pressure. Maybe the last time was in René Bordelon's green-walled study. René. She took another draught of beer, tasting hatred along with it. In Zeitburg, her hate had tasted bitter. Now it was a sweet thing, because now she could do something about it. The satchel at her feet held a Luger. Not her old Luger with the scratch on the barrel. The one René had taken from her. But it would do. Cameron, for all his gentlemanly air, knocked the gin back as fast as Eve, giving a murmured toast of Gabrielle. When Eve raised her eyebrows, he explained.
"Another of my recruits. Shot in April of 16. I rotate them. The ones I lost."
He raised his beer and said,
"Leon,"
before downing a swallow.
"Was I in your rotation?" "No. Only those confirmed dead."
Cameron's eyes had that terrible drowning softness again.
"Every week following your trial, I expected to get the news you died in Siegburg. After Lily, I almost did."
They looked at each other a long time, and then they ordered another round of gin.
"Lily."
They were both silent, until Cameron abruptly started saying something about a pension for Eve.
"You'll find it more useful than the medals. I knew you didn't have any family, so I pushed a pension for you through the War Office. It's not much, but it'll keep you afloat. Maybe help you buy a house somewhere in London."
"Thank you." Eve didn't want the medals, but she'd take the pension. It wasn't like she'd be going back to typewriting with hands like hers. She needed something to live on. Cameron studied her.
"Your stammer's better.
Go to prison, and you find there are worse things than a halting tongue." She took another draught of beer.
"And this helps."
He set down his glass.
"Eve, if I can.
So what are you going to do now?" She cut him off fast, before he could say anything he'd regret.
"I was sent to Russia for a while, during their bit of upheaval. Siberia. The things I saw."
He sat blank-faced for a moment, and Eve wondered what he was seeing through the curtain of remembered Russian snows. She didn't ask.
"It's Ireland next for me," he resumed. "To run a training school. School for what? People like you."
"Who needs people like me anymore? The war's over." He laughed bitterly.
"There's always another war, Eve."
Eve didn't even want to think about the next war, or a generation of new, fresh-faced spies who would be fed into its gaping mouth. At least they'd have a good teacher.
"When do you leave?" "Soon."
"Is your wife going?"
"Yes. And our child."
"I'm glad you had... that is, I know your wife wanted a child." How wearying these courtesies were. Eve felt like she was struggling under a boulder.
"What did you decide to name?"
He spoke softly.
"Evelyn."
Eve stared down at the sticky tabletop. "Why not Lily?" she heard herself ask. "Why not Gabrielle, or any of your others? Why was it me, Cameron?"
"If you could see yourself, you wouldn't ask,"
I can see myself. I'm a wreck. Nothing could wreck you either.